Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, it is your partner, Big Boy. Interested in giving back to your community while making new connections in your neighborhood? Introducing Neighbor to Neighbor, a California volunteers network that empowers you to take action, contribute to local needs, and be a part of something bigger than yourself. Visit CANeighbors.com to learn more about how you can get to know your neighbor and strengthen your community. Neighbor to Neighbor, it takes a neighborhood. Hello.
For all the latest betting markets, odds and promotions, visit williamhill.com. 18 plus, please gamble responsibly. William Hill, it's who you play with.
Hello and welcome to Middle Please Umpire. My name is Miles Jupp and I'm joined as ever by World Cup winning England cricketer and indeed Owl substitute Mark Wood. Whistle and he'll come to you. How are you, Mark?
Hello, Miles. How are you? We're talking of whistles. Have you perfected the wood whistle yet?
I keep forgetting it. Is that it?
See, got it in one there. Eventually we're there. So if I'm in the supermarket in Ashington and I hear that whistle, now I know it's you.
Which supermarkets are there in Ashington?
Of course, there is Asda, Aldi. There's a Lidl.
Yeah.
Iceland.
You got home bargains?
Yes, we have got a home bargain.
Very useful home bargains, particularly for confectionery.
Now that we've added in five there, I'm never going to find you, Emma. I'm going to be in Iceland and you're going to be in home bargains.
I'm going to be in the middle of Lidl having an absolute ball. because, do you know, if you go to the Lidl website, and this is useful information not just for cricket fans, you might think that the middle of Lidl is just a series of random items, but if you go to the website, they actually tell you in advance what is going to be in the middle of Lidl. It's all absolutely brilliantly planned out.
I like to leave it as a surprise. I just want to see what's in there. What can I bring out? I don't want to know beforehand.
Well, it's very useful at this time of the year if you've got a partner who always says things like, "Oh, just surprise me." They weren't expecting whatever it might be. You know, a fleece, an incredibly heavy torch. Yeah. 9 foot pumps. It's brilliant. So if I go into any of the supermarkets in Ashington, I have to do it on a sort of rotor system, and I go. And do you just prick your ears up, or do you run towards the sound?
No, you'll get it back, and then we continuously do until we meet. And the whistle gets closer and closer. Bang, we're together. We do a podcast in the middle of Aldi.
You are like an owl, then. Isn't that how owls move around in the dark? Because the sound bounces off trees and stuff. That's how they work out how far away they are from things. No, you said it was. Well, you said it's because you were always hooting. It's because of you eat a lot of sort of worms and stuff like that. Well, you don't eat all of them. Some of them you just collect for your young. And of course, you use sort of just sound to navigate your way in the dark. If you go to the supermarket, Mark, do you get absolutely mobbed? With people saying things like, "Can you tell me where the frozen goods aisle is?"
No, absolutely not. Probably the place I get recognised the most is probably London, more than anywhere. I mean, in my hometown and stuff, no one really bothers me or anything like that. I think it's, or in the northeast in general, obviously, it's a massive football place up here, so I just slide under the radar nicely. How about you? Do you get swamped there?
Sometimes. Well, I mean, I live here, so it's just a sort of completely normal. I'm, wandering about aimlessly for much of the time. But yeah, London.
And they're like, there's that fast bowler, Miles Jupp.
There's that guy who's played two games for Monmouth Thirds and is seriously considering asking if he can drop down to the fours next season. Yeah, a lot of chat. We've just got our new kit, actually. I think I'm going to get a Monmouth beanie.
And was that for Christmas? Obviously, you've got your Christmas list in, I'm assuming, and Monmouth beanie was top of it?
That's right, yeah. I just did. I don't know if you heard it, Mark. I can't remember if you listened to Radio 4 at 8 o'clock on Monday evenings. I just did a programme. I went to the Arctic Circle. Well, I didn't just do it. I did it last year when there was slightly more freedom of movement for political and health reasons. Mm. And I actually went to the town where Father Christmas lives, the post office, where they saw all the letters, and I met him.
And how was that?
It was extraordinary, actually. It was, I mean, in a way, he's exactly as you'd expect him to be.
Was there any cricket bats in there? Who's he sponsored by?
Who's he sponsored by? Well, he is, he's one of those people, he's got Kookaburra stickers, but I know it's a Newbury. So now it's Christmas. We should explain the context of this. We're recording this just a few days before Christmas. I myself have come upstairs with a glass of Prosecco. I've been absolutely sweating over a Yule log downstairs. What are you up to, Mark?
I always find that it's a bit sad this time of year. It reminds me of school, where unfortunately me and my friend Jonathan Nelson, we, I would say, fathered a couple of rabbits in the school field. Right. This is year seven, year eight. We used to go every day to feed them, and unfortunately, we didn't get the nutrition right. We kept thinking that they would eat carrots, and they didn't. And unfortunately, those rabbits didn't survive. So it's always a sad time of year, but it makes me reflect on, you know, school life around this time of year, swapping Pokemon cards and Pogs. That was all the rage in my school.
What's Pogs?
Pogs is the little sort of discs that you would flip and try and knock. You never played Pogs?
I've never played Pogs.
Pokemon cards, then?
Pokemon cards. Well, our children have Pokemon cards. I've not. I struggle to work out the rules are. Pokemon Go, though, if you could download that on your mobile, that is an excellent way of taking children for a 5 mile walk without them noticing. You know, I'm sort of looking at my step counter, whereas they're saying, "Look, we found another, whatever he is, the big yellow one. It's called Pokey McPokeface." What's he called?
Ponyo.
No, that's a completely different thing.
Are you on about Pikachu?
Pikachu. That's the fellow. Yeah. Do you know who he's sponsored by?
Newbury, but I think it's just Cougar and
Pass. Close, actually. He has never been able to get rid of his old Graham Gooch 333.
Of course, I would get to hang around with the Chavas at this time of year. Now, a Chava in the Northeast is the same as a Chav anywhere else in the country. So I'd get to hang around with them at this time of year simply because I had a good throw. So of course, when it would be snowy this time of year, because I was athletic and had a good arm, I would manage to get in with those lads for a couple of weeks until I realised at the end, when the snow melted, that I had absolutely no banter with them whatsoever. Then I'd be shipped on again.
What sort of length run-up did you have in those days? Was that before you lengthened it?
just a sort of stand and throw by us, I would say.
So when I was at school, I went to a boarding school, and we used to do a thing where I realised when I was quite young that I could do a thing where I would go into somebody else's room, and they'd be, so like someone older, say, and they'd be playing snowballs in front of the building, and I would open the window and start being rude to them, and they'd start throwing snowballs at me. And I remember one guy in particular, a big guy, and I kept being really rude to him. He kept throwing snowballs at me. And he was like, I'm going to hit you, I'm going to hit you. And after about 10 minutes, I went, you know that I'm in your room.
You don't really get snow nowadays on Christmas, do you? Which is a bit disappointing.
Well, the world is facing a number of quite serious issues at the moment, of which the dearth of serious snowballing is but one of the symptoms. But it will come now. It comes at unexpected times. It's suddenly like heavy snow in April and things like that now.
Yeah. Well, we played a game for Durham a couple of years ago, and Middlesex had their beanie hats on, not their county caps.
I remember seeing the footage of Peter Siddle bowling with a beanie on.
That's right. You see, these southerners.
It could have been that he was waiting for his new hair dye to dry, but I think he was just sort of...
That is true.
It sort of looks all right. Perhaps I'll get to bowl a whole two overs of off spin next year and wearing my Monmouth Town beanie. I don't care what the weather is. For me, it's all about the look.
I'm in a great mood because some of my favourite films are on today. We've got Clash of the Titans.
Wait, can I try and guess your favourite films? You've said one, Clash of the Titans. Now, what do I know about Mark Wood?
Don't look at me. You might turn me into stone. You've got that Medusa look about you.
He likes owls. He can't. Marzipan bungs him up a bit. He likes bowling in Home Alone 2.
I do like Home Alone 2, but it's not one of the ones...
Well, you probably like the Bird Woman. You like the Bird Woman in Central Park. You sort of naturally...
She's been... I've seen that Piers Morgan's been... They've been saying that Piers Morgan looks like that woman, and that made me chuckle. I'm going to stop you there.
Kez.
Clash of... That's a
Harry
great
Potter.
Film. Kez is a great film.
No, tell me. What are your favourite marks?
So we've got Clash of the Titans
Love
on
Actually.
Today, which... No.
Fucking no. Absolutely.
Clash of the Titans is on today. We've got The Searchers, which is John Wayne. I love John Wayne. He's on today as well. And if I mean, they would both be in my top 10. If you were to have maybe Jason and the Argonauts on as well today, then I think I'd have all three covered and I wouldn't need to watch anything else for a week.
Is that your sort of era? Do you like things like Ben-Hur?
Yeah, I like old films.
Spartacus.
Obviously, Spartacus. When I was growing up with my granddads, I used to watch all the John Wayne films and stuff like that. So yeah, I love stuff like that. Which is probably why all the England lads think I'm weird with my taste in music and taste in movies.
You could have an absolute feast then over the next few days. Okay, let's look at some correspondence. This is about teas. This is from Matt Spencer. Hi, Woody and Miles. I was enjoying listening to your last episode when I felt the urge to get in touch to tell you about the best club cricket tea in Europe. 2018, Ploughman's Cricket Club in Surrey were fortunate enough to go on our tour among the hills of central Portugal. On top of one such hill sits the home of the best club cricket tea in Europe. Amigos Cricket Club set about offering gin and tonics while we sat down to tuck into a buffet of delight. Every item of food you could imagine being mentioned in a story about a good cricket tea was here on display, freshly made or baked to the ground, suitably oversized to feed not just the day's players, but the touring supporters and home fans too. Now, they've actually attached photos of it. That is a spread. I dropped a catch, was responsible for an overthrow, also got a duck. It resulted in them dressing me as a fox, but that's a story for another day. I'm not sure if he's describing a cricket tour or a stag night. Right, superstitions, lucky charms. Alex Knott, hi Miles and Mark, love the podcast and Mark's Ashington accent, which reminds me of home. Presumably Ashington is his home. I'm emailing you both with what I hold in my cricket bag, which I believe gives me luck. It is an empty 2-litre bottle of Pepsi with an old sock in it. I have had this in my bag from a game against, now what does that say, Bormersund?
That's right around the corner from me, Bormersund.
I've had this in my bag from a game against Bormersund in 2017. I just arrived back from a holiday in Vietnam the morning of the game and was asked at short notice to play that day. I foolishly accepted despite being jet-lagged and suffering from an unknown tropical disease. Oh my goodness. I turned up at the ground late. We were fielding. Normally I find myself in the covers or mid-wicket, but since I was being violently sick... I was sent to fine leg. I was periodically throwing up over the boundary and taking big swigs of the drink for some energy. Turns out the ball gets hit your way a lot when you're chundering. However, I managed two catches and a direct hit followed up with my best batting score despite just wanting to go home and die. To this day, I have no idea how the sock got into the bottle, but it remains in my bag. Oh, that's excellent. That is an extraordinary tale.
The best superstitions I've ever heard that.
That's right. Also from Jonathan Williams. When I was a wicketkeeper, I always had to do a 360-degree turn between each delivery. I just didn't feel at ease and concentrated for the next ball if I didn't do it. Mostly I tried to do it subtly, surveying the field while the bowler returned to his mark, so it was less obvious. However, when the spinners were on, it made it happen somewhat quicker. An opposition batsman once compared it to a dog spinning before laying down. Very charming, like a sort of whirling dervish. Well, thank you very much indeed for your correspondence. Do continue to send in correspondence about teas or indeed superstitions, quirks. Now, in this episode, we've got an interview, haven't we, Mark?
Yes, yes.
I've often done before.
Do you want to give a clue to the viewers again, as we normally do? Or?
Yeah, I think that's a very good idea. So he's about 6 foot.
David Gower.
It's David. It is indeed. It's David Gower. That's right. We met him, actually... I mean, we should set the scene. This was way back in October.
Way back.
So a very different very different world we were living in. And perverse as it seems now, we actually were all in the same room together.
Yep.
Which, looking back, in hindsight, knowing what we know now, was, I mean, frankly, no safer than an orgy. but presumably about as pleasurable.
I actually remember leaving there, I really enjoyed it and stuff. But it seems like just so long ago that we did that, and it's just so much has happened, not just in the cricketing world, but in life in general, hasn't it?
So then, little break coming up, and after that we're going to be talking to, have you put all the cues together yet, Mark?
David Gower.
Yes, David Gower, yeah. I'd just like to take a moment to thank our sponsors who have helped make this podcast possible. Cricketer's Gin is the perfect pairing for tonic, but also this podcast, as they also believe in creating something enjoyable around the sport we love. Cricketer's is an exquisite local gin, a family business, and was inspired during a game of cricket on a sunny village green in Pinckneys, Berkshire. The founders decided that the quintessential British game, along with the wild botanicals growing in abundance nearby, deserved a bespoke artisan gin of its own. Cricketer's is distilled to the highest London gin standards. All the ingredients are natural and added before distillation, ensuring it's the purest form of gin, and that Cricketer's delivers a beautifully smooth, juniper-forward gin. You can find this wonderful cricketing tipple at cricketersgin.com, and we thank them for their support. There is a special 10% discount if you use the code POD.
William Hill's safer gambling tools help you stay in control. You can set deposit limits, session reminders, and take timeouts whenever you need them. 18 plus, please gamble responsibly. William Hill, it's who you play with.
Gower, 99 not out. He's cut that one away, and that's his 100. A magnificent 100, full of stroke play. What an innings by David Gower. His team back to the wall, and he has scored his 18th Test 100, his 9th against Australia.
I think we should, if it's all right with you, we should introduce one of the best England players
please,
ever.
Please.
Another of the best England players ever. It's David Gower. David Gower, hello.
Miles, very good afternoon. Good morning, good evening, wherever we are, whatever we're doing, wherever this takes place. Whichever the bubble.
It's all unprecedented, every aspect of it. David, I assume you've been having an excellent lockdown. You'd laid stuff down in
is
advance.
Is that chateau bottled? It's not been as bubbled as Mark's experience. Obviously, I wasn't required on duty anyway at any stage during the test matches. But it was nice to be able to watch the cricket, for sure. Nice to be able to see actually coverage focused on the game itself, which Sky did very, very, very well indeed. I mean, no crowd shots, so Bumble's role was curtailed, rather, not being able to talk to the crowd, you know, for most of the day. But I thought it worked rather well. I thought, actually, credit is due to everyone for getting on the field. And I know it's been said a million times, but the West Indies and Pakistan to come and help, you know, be part of that was extraordinary. So for those stuck at home, for whatever reason, and having cricket to watch, it was great.
I was happy in the end that, you know, we got so much cricket in and all that kind of thing. But I look back now and I think, how did I cope with that for so long? I honestly don't know how would you have coped with that, Fane?
Not well, not well. The question was asked whether or not our generation would have been able to cope with the bubble in the same way. Because as Mark so rightly said, whether you're my age or his age, cricket is the sort of game where you quite like to go out at the end of the day, relax, eat, drink, be merry, come back and compete again the following morning. So with that taken away, the whole rhythm of your game is destroyed. I mean, it saves time not having to book a restaurant. It saves time not having to pick a wine, you know, sort of decide where to go. But I can imagine the Baron of Beef, who, his lordship, who would have been very, very constrained by, even though he might be able to eat in his own restaurant for 30 nights consecutively in Southampton. You know, beef is the chain that never was. You know, it's the first one was there and it's still there. but, you know, all that sheer repetition, because I'm not great with dull repetition, I have to say.
Because also in your day, David, you'd all have been sharing rooms as well, wouldn't you? You wouldn't have just have been having nothing to do, but you'd have had to do it in close proximity.
I think with the COVID protocols, that we could have had a very good excuse to abandon that arcane practice.
You know, it could have been like you and Paul Downton could have been forced to become a household bubble or something.
Well, the ones we used to worry about were obviously Beefy, who has never dealt with boredom well, but normally through liquid and other substances. People like Lammy, AJ Lamb, Alan Joseph Lamb, one of England's finest, born in Langebaanvech. Lammy again. Those are sort of two of my great friends from that era, and they were neither of them renowned for early nights or allowing any opportunity to pass. So you can imagine, being stuck in your room after an early steak at Beefy's and wondering what to watch next. Just waiting for dawn would not have been good for them.
You mean the games room wouldn't have interested you with the basketball, the darts, the air hockey, the table tennis, the Pac-Man game that we had in there? That would have interested you every night?
No. That's the sort of thing we used to do in sort of Pakistan in 1980-something. If you had a table tennis table, something just to do.
There's only so much you can do. You can't keep going to nets,
Oh, God, heaven forbid.
Perhaps in lockdown you'd have been so bored, David, that you would have gone to
one,
nets.
Yes.
Well, I have to try at some point. Now, of course, we've just been discussing Beefies. What were your feelings recently when your erstwhile colleague Ian Botham became a member of the House of Lords? I mean, in a way, not surprising, is it? Because, if you think about Ian Botham, one of the first things you always think is, now there is a man that venerates democracy. What does everyone else think is what Ian Botham always says.
Yes. It's a fascinating thing. I've obviously known Ian for a long time, 40-odd years. And during those 40-odd years, every now and again, over a curry and a huge quantity of red wine, we've listened to some of his political ideas. And they've been quite radical. In fact, they've been extremely radical. And they've not really made it to the mainstream.
Trump's ascendancy to the presidency,
until the Donald made them seem reasonable. What interests me about him is that he has always taken on challenges. So this to me, this to him is potentially another challenge. But he doesn't really like London much, so it's a bit awkward to get to the House of Lords if you don't like London. And I don't know how many sort of his many interests he's going to actually want to speak on. But when he gets involved, I'm sure he will get involved with a passion. But, I mean, there's a lot of... There is, if you are honest about the job, there is a lot of stuff that is deadly dull. Stuff that comes through the Commons, goes into the Lords, needs to be read, debated, thought about, sent back again. I mean, that is the mundane business of the Lords. And
he's got to do it wearing the same costume he was wearing in Bournemouth pantomime nearly 30 years ago.
I think I watched him there. I think I saw that wooden performance too. It was held together. Those panto days, and they've drawn us luckily onto something much, much less serious. Those panto days, I genuinely went to watch Ian Botham in pantomime in Bournemouth with Robin Asquith, who is a great mutual friend of ours. Who is a very, very funny man, a classic. I mean, he's much better than just being a panto actor. Max Boyce, who'd written, directed, cajoled, coached. Do it like this, Ian. He somehow got Ian into performance mode for the panto. And all that Robin...
Oh, no, he didn't. Got you. I got you there, Dale. Got you back. See that bad. Straight in there.
Oh, God. Can you edit that out, please?
You'd be a good Buttons, I think, Mark. I think you'd be very good sort of being cheeky during the song shoot.
I couldn't help myself.
I remember Asquith found that the hardest thing to do, pantomime with Ian Botham, because Asquith and Boyce would work their nuts off through the game, the performance, the drama, the panto for 2 hours. And with Asquith, it normally went 2 hours, went into three, because he'd ad-libbed so much that the thing would go on forever. Beefy did his sort of 10-minute stint with a pissing dog and would spray the audience and wander off and have a beer. And when they all came off knackered, he would say, right, come on, lads, time for a drink. So, I mean, this is the Ian Botham experience transferred from the cricket field to the theatre, which we've all had to deal with for 40 years. And it is not just, the 6-7 hours on the field during the day that you have to cope with. It is the 6-7 hours that follow up where he goes at the same pace and always has done, which is an extraordinary feat of human endurance.
And now he's been given a job in a building full of several publicly subsidised bars. I mean, I can't see anything going particularly wrong.
You won't like the fact they have to close at 10 at the moment.
Look, David, we've got an extraordinarily quick bowler here.
Yep.
Mark.
Thanks for clearing that up, mate.
Just in case. I know people think...
I had to look to both sides of the room there to make sure who I was looking at there.
Obviously, you two have played in very different eras. There's been like an era between you, I suppose. When you're watching someone like Mark, can you think about how you... I mean, you've faced seriously quick... Who's the quickest player you faced?
Take your pick from... Michael Holding, Andy Roberts, Malcolm Marshall, Joel Garner, Colin Croft, Sylvester Clark, Wayne Daniel.
Of course, they played a lot of bowlers in those, didn't they? They kind of been a bit light on the batting.
It's just, these are the thoughts I would have been left alone with in my room in the bubble. Which, I'd have been screaming, clawing at the window. That's a horrible sound you get from fingernails on windows.
You faced a lot of pace, proper pace. Yeah. But Mark is that's proper pace, isn't it? They're not hitting 95 consistently as Mark.
I bet you they did. You didn't have the speed gun on them then.
Well, I suppose let's call you two the cricket guys. If that's what you say, you say.
I think the serious point is this. There's not much point in trying to split hairs between 1985, say, and the current day, because the odd mile an hour, the odd sort of yard of pace, when they're quick, when you're Mark's pace and you're noticeably quick, then it's the same for any batsman in any era. Your heart rate goes up, you have just that split second less than you had against the ordinary sort of medium pacers to do something about it. Fear and anxiety come back into play. And if you've got the ability, as the modern-day bowler has, to make things happen. I mean, there were people... the greatest, I thought, of that West Indies era was probably Malcolm Marshall, because he was so good at adapting to any condition. Quick pitch, he could bowl quick. Slow pitch, he could pitch it up and swing it and seam it and stuff. And the great Pakistanis, Wasim Akram, Waqar Yunus, they had pace. Watching, for instance, Wasim do masterclasses now for Sky, you just... see it, the ball in his hand, down it goes, three paces, down it goes, swinging. I saw Matthew Hoggard playing for the Lord's Taverners at Wormsley, and he doesn't run up to the crease anymore. He takes two steps walking and gets into an action, which, again, this ball just swings. So the natural ability to do something with a cricket ball never seems to disappear. So if you combine that sort of ability with this sort of pace we're talking about, a Mark and any of that sort of era, any of that sort of ilk, rather... then that whatever the generation, whatever the year, whatever the decade, whatever the century, that creates problems.
Mark's at the top of his delivery. You're in your pomp. What are you hoping for? What are you dreading?
Well, in his case, you dread the skiddy bouncer, because the one that's... the easy bouncer to play, it doesn't matter whether you're 60 miles an hour or 90 miles an hour or 100. The easy one is sort of the loopy one that goes high and wide and you just see it from the hand and you know it's never going to hit you. The nasty one is the one that either sort of follows you or doesn't really get up as high as you suspect it would. So if you've got his sort of pace and his sort of trajectory, you're not necessarily ducking as confidently as you might. You might try and sway, but any batsman, even the greatest in the world, will tell you that you acknowledge you're going to get into trouble at some stage. One's going to be in just the wrong place, just the awkward height or whatever it might be. And if it hurts, it hurts. As long as it doesn't do too much damage, it's fine. You start again. And all you really want is, in my case, is something sort of length, the tiny little bit of width, just a little bit offline. We sort of just time it and use the pace to get the ball away.
So he's dreading the skiddy bouncer. What are you, if you're bowling Mark to David in his pomp, what are you starting on?
My hands are sweating just now thinking about it. I think, obviously, with the most... elegant cover drive in the game, I'd almost want to bowl it there just so he could hit one. I'd just be like, wow, I've just bowled the David Gower cover drive.
This first one,
I was just saying before we came on, we were talking about Marcus Truscothic, weren't we, and how he, I still wake up in the night sometimes screaming hearing him just shout run, because that means that he's timed it through the cover spot four. I mean, you often think that you're going to get him out because he doesn't move his feet, and you think his strength's a weakness, but when he times it, it's a... And, going back to David's point before about fast bowling, I think even nowadays, because lads, they've got all the protective gear on, which they didn't always have in David's era. We've got the dog sticks now that lads really ramp that up to bowl at 80 odd, 90 mile an hour. So that they're used to now bowling machines. You're getting used to your eyes and getting used to the pitches, the fast indoors, the training pitches outside. You're getting used to that pace. So the one thing that you've got to have is not just straight up and down pace. Otherwise, the best players in the world now, you're not going to get them out. So you have to find a way, whether it's on a slow pitch, a fast pitch, a seaming pitch, of trying to get the ball off the straight, which is, in my career, something which I've not done notoriously well at, which is something that I'm trying to work. You look at the likes of Broad, Anderson, I mean, they would seam the ball on glass. So you've got to try and find something in your armoury to try and get that ball off the straight, because pace is great, but against your top players like David was, it's not going to get them out. You have to get that ball to move a little bit as well.
Possibly just veering in the direction of second slip or something.
Oh, that would be beautiful.
That'd be just
after the cover drive, though. I've got to have at least one where it'd be sort of angry at him, but sort of happy at the same time. Oh, good shot, David.
Because you played recently, didn't you? You played in South Africa?
It's a very loose term. I'd taken the view for a long, long time that my best days were behind me, and that's where they were best left.
Yeah.
And for a couple of years after I retired from professional cricket, played some very good benefit games, some of them quite against good players, and so quite nice standard, therefore competitive. And then you start to go downhill and you're playing in games that are rubbish and you get no enjoyment from it. And I thought, stop. After 20 odd years of saying no fervently, in the going back to Cape Town, where you hope to go in the new year, we were there with the Lord's Taverners, having a very nice party one night in a garden in Bishop's Court, which you can imagine is beautiful. A couple of stumps in the lawn, tennis ball, that sort of stuff. Knocking it to all parts, and someone said, Paul Pritchard, actually, who captains the Taverners overseas. Pritch said, come on, Lubo, you can have a game tomorrow, can't you? I said, no, come on, mate. Following day, having done stint umpiring, immaculately counted to six several times and correctly, come the tea break, come on, Lubo, you can do it. So I found myself borrowing whites, sticking pads on, which I could vaguely remember how to do it, borrowing the right sort of size and shape, borrowing a left-handed pair of batting gloves, looking at a bat, thinking, yes, I can still lift this, putting the sunglasses on with the prescription lenses and the white floppy hat, whereas Pritch is there with a helmet again. So I take that off. Come on, you're embarrassing me. So I walked out to open the innings, with Pritch, who is now mighty happy. And I was quite nervous. I'm very, very nervous, because you think, well, I haven't done this for so long properly. And what I would have preferred would have been to have someone sort of brisk medium, just short of a length, just sort of get you into the rhythm. But the guy at the other end, who's, I think, a very fine player in his day, but well past 50 now, bowled one of those slow, loopy, medium pace, vaguely swinging deliveries, where I sort of looked at it a bit longer, failed to move my feet, missed it. And if the umpire had been doing his job properly, that would have been the end of it. Because it was as plumb as you fucking like. And he uttered the immortal words, no, we've come to see him bat, so not out. So I then got a full toss, hit that for four, got a short one, ping that over mid-wicket, and then was just starting to enjoy it. And this is the lesson for all those that make comebacks. Just starting to enjoy it, getting into a bit of rhythm, and there was a guy at the other end who was sort of fast medium. I was quite ping, back foot, inside edge, onto the stumps, end of story. So you wander off, do the typical thing, wander off, and this sort of brings back old memories as well. You wander off, and I never know which is worse, low dudgeon or high dudgeon. I was not happy. I was sulky. So I wander off, sulked for half an hour in the dressing room, threw the pads into one corner, gave the bat back to the owner of the bat.
Did it all come back to you, though? Could you still remember how to really smash up a dressing room when you were in there? Chuck all the coffins
that
out of the balcony.
Guitar thrown into the corner. I remembered, you do remember. For one who's meant to have had a reputation of being cool, calm, collected and laid back, you do remember the times where you are really, really angry at getting out. Mainly because it's your fault and you're aware it's your fault. Because I always took the view, if a Mark Wood or someone bowled you something that was largely unplayable and you nicked it, well bowled. I'm not going to lose sleep over that. But when you know you've done something heinously wrong yourself as a batsman, that's the time you beat yourself up. So, there were times I used to take it out on dressing room walls and this, that and the other.
Stokes, he's got one framed, hasn't he, at Is it Eden Garden in New Zealand? It's he punched a his bat. He like punched the bat into the wall, and the bottom of his bat shape went into the wall, and they framed it and said, "This is Ben Stokes 20."
Oh yeah, artwork donated by Ben Stokes. Well, there, did Hayden do it as well? Did Hayden smash a door at the SCG?
NASA's got form.
Yeah. Bins and stuff. NASA.
Bins and all sorts, yeah.
Well, Pryor as well. And Pryor threw a bat that bounced
Lords,
up.
Lords, I mean, that window, actually, that's the same window I used to change by.
It's been a good court on that. Roots sits there now, David Gower. There's plenty of runs in that corner. I'm obviously sat in the wrong place.
How would I ever have been in there? Has everyone, you'd have a set place then, always?
We do, yeah. A lot of the lads do. Every ground around the country and every away ground, especially the senior players.
Test venues. I mean, if you've got a bench you like to sit on at Derby.
No, but Lords I do, yeah. I've tried two or three different places.
And is it when the hierarchy kicks in? You can't sit there.
That definitely happens.
If you're playing... the Derek Pringle seat or whatever it is, you can't.
It's the one with the books. There's a hierarchy, as you say, because if you're coming in for your first test match at Lords, you hang back to see where there's a space. And if the guys who've played for the last 10 years go to their places, well, you look for that space and you go, okay, I'll go there. And then if you are good enough to last for another few seasons, you eye up a spot where you'd like to go when you get to that seriously high rank.
Absolutely right.
I'd like to sit in that spot where Matt Pryor doesn't hurl bats at me. That would be really... If you got even abroad, though, like with the SCG or somewhere, would you have the same place where you would sit?
Not quite in the same way, but you'd still have sort of first choice.
I would say Alistair Cook had a spot in Australia a couple of times because he'd done well there. And when we then went back there, because he'd done well in that seat, he wanted to sit in that seat again. So I think that's pretty standard practice, that if you've done well somewhere or you've sat somewhere...
But is that superstitious?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, yes. I mean, you will do anything, batter or bowler, to recreate the perfect circumstance to repeat what you got right last time if you go back there. So, I mean, that's... One reason, if you found your spot at Lords and kept getting naught, you might decide to move. But if you go to the SCG, MCG, wherever, and you get hundreds, and you are lucky enough to be there 4 years later when the next tour is on, then you'll say, right, excuse me, I need to sit here, please. I mean, all those superstitions, I mean, I don't know what they're like nowadays. I mean, mine were ridiculous. I mean, socks, pads.
There was nothing you wouldn't wear. I mean,
someone else's pads, bags.
Well, yes, see, the wrong superstition. That's where it went wrong in Cape Town, you know. You'll do anything to keep your mind believing that it's going to be a good day.
So what I'm fascinated though, the idea the first time you walk into, because it's the start of something, but it's also the culmination. You know, if you dream of playing for England, then the thing, you know, there's the actual on the field stuff, but you're like, it's putting on the sweater and stuff, and that's only the start of the thing. It's like
I remember my first time into Lords and where people sat. I still remember it now, walking in. And
so who's in your first dressing room?
So as you go into the Lords, obviously up the stairs, and then you go into through the door, and there's a big table in the middle, and it's sort of the seats follow the room around, so it's sort of the chairs bend around the room, and there's a long bench on the back, and on the back bench, it was Cook, Anderson, Broad, Stokes, Plunkett, my first game. And then Bell sat, as you go in, straight in, Bell was in front. And on the opposite side, where I'm assuming David sat at the window, is where Joe Root sat. Mo and Ali was next to the physio bed. So I can remember a lot of where people sat, and I took the first space next to the door because I sort of assumed that, well, everyone's piled in, I'll just sort of plonk myself here nice and quietly, it's my first game. And then now I sit on that back bench near where Liam Puckett and Joss Butler used to sit, because that's, I didn't do well in that spot, I kept getting injured, so I thought, right, I'm not sitting there anymore, I keep getting whacked here at Lords, I'm not going to sit here, I'm going to sit there. And since I've sat there, we won the World Cup, so I'll be staying there from now on.
So who's the first person then to say, you know, welcome or hello? When you first stepped into the England camp, what was the first sort of happy, welcoming face?
So we have, it wasn't a very happy and welcoming, but Phil Neal, the team manager, is the first person to greet you. And he's a bit of a he'll do anything for you, but he's a bit of a dour character. All right, I'm Phil, nice to meet you. Your kit's there, sit there, such and such is there. Trains at 10 o'clock, see you soon. Yeah. So it's like, all right, okay. And then, of course, the captain and everyone comes up to you. Alistair Cook was the captain at the time. And, he sort of was like, any questions, just come find me. But I knew a few of the lads from, obviously, Durham and...
so you knew Plunkett and Stokes.
Yeah, and played age groups against Root and... Bestow was my age and stuff like that. So I didn't play for Durham as a kid. I played for Northumberland. So growing up, we would play the likes of Mighty Yorkshire and we would always have to bowl first because we'd be all out for 30 for Northumberland. So it was I knew a lot of their lads and looked up to a lot of them in a way, thinking, oh, I don't think I'll ever get to that standard there. You know, they're playing for the Mighty Yorkshire. They're all this good. And it wasn't until I started going through the Durham ranks and started bowling a bit quicker that I eventually thought, you know what it is, I can compete with these guys. Then I get picked up with the England Lions and I'm thinking, well, I don't think I'm good enough to be here. And then you get into it and you think, actually, I can hold my own. I am just as good as Onions, a Plunkett, a Bresnan, who are all there. I can compete with them. Then you get up to England and the same thing happens. It isn't until you do well, I would say, at England. I don't know. Obviously, David started really well, so... But I didn't particularly start that well. So it wasn't until I got that 5 foot under my belt that I felt like I truly belonged, which is quite a strange feeling.
So is that where does the belief come from things that you've achieved? Do you have to achieve something you don't know you can achieve?
Not necessarily.
Believe?
I think at England level, I felt like that, but not at the other levels. At the other levels, I felt like I could compete by, you know, the way that I trained, the way that I went about things, my mindset. I felt like they had the same doubts and that as me, whereas at England level, the pressure is just that little bit more. It's a little bit different. You obviously get the scrutiny and in your heart of hearts, you believe in your inner self that you are good enough, but you then don't show that reputation, which then can create problems and then that can spiral. So I think then when eventually that 5 foot or 100 or something like that does come, I mean, I can think of James Vince, Mark Stoneman. These are lads who are definitely good enough to play for England, but just never got that 100 under their belt. I think David went off like an absolute train, didn't he? So he maybe
didn't. Scored 100 in your second game, did you? 50 in your first innings.
I mean, it's just, to be fair, one of the lucky things was that it was the time of World Series, Packer, and all that. So teams that we played against were not necessarily at full strength. So Pakistan, against whom I made my debut, had no Imran. As one major example, because he was part of World Series.
I saw his stats the other day. Imran's stats as captain are absolutely astonishing. I can't remember any of them, but they are. but I can remember the adjective.
Yeah. But so, I mean, and we beat them reasonably easily. So I only had one innings per game for the first three games. And then we played New Zealand, who were a decent side, but would get better. And that first 100 came in the first test against New Zealand. So that was, I mean, that's right. It's whatever, the sooner you get to that landmark, the better it is and the more quickly you feel part of the right environment.
So you're 20 when you make your England
21.
Debut. 21.
Yeah.
Can you remember as vividly? What's the dressing room? Can you remember anyone else who played?
No. I mean, there were people. My first test match was at Birmingham, Edgbaston.
Yeah, Lia Katali.
Lia Katali was, who's he? Famous quiz question, of course, but Learcat was the man who bowled the first ball. I remember the commentary from, was it John Arlott on the radio, said, a princely entry into Test match cricket. I mean, it just takes you back, doesn't it? But answering the same question as you asked to Mark, people like Bob Willis were there. So Bob's one, come do this. It's a bit of a guiding hand. Cyril, otherwise known as Graham Roop, was having his little bit of an England career at the time. And the sort of, unlike the sort of modern era where you're there for sort of 3 or 4 days in a normal year, as opposed to sort of 3 weeks of a bubble, but 3 or 4 days before a game, together, practicing, training, eating, all the rest of it. It was Wednesday afternoon, cup of tea at 3, quick net, maybe, couple of catches, another cup of tea, team dinner, play. So after team dinner that first night, I remember Cyril took me for a sort of quick glass of anything you need to know, you're nervous, a little bit, blah, blah. So a calming pint of
something. Yeah, a little bit, Bob, for England, a little bit,
It's just a game of cricket, it's just a bit of fun. A
couple of the rules I'm still a bit unsure of. And I feel I'm in too deep now
offside
to ask.
Offside?
What does the L in LBW?
But it just takes someone to, as it were, put either a physical or a mental arm around you and say, come on, you'll be fine.
So who's the most intimidating person in that dressing room? I mean, already you'd shared a dressing room with Ray Illingworth by that point, was he?
Yeah. Bless him, the late, great Bob Willis. Bob was, as so many people said on his death, was a very, very good man with a very warm heart and a keen sense of wanting everyone to do well, both as a colleague and later on briefly as a captain. So, yes, he would be keen to welcome you, but also quite brusque and quite intimidating because his method, if you remember Bob, that sort of bubble of his own, that sort of little area surrounding his head, which he immersed himself in when he was bowling. I mean, he was a very intimidating-looking person. And so if he was... and his style, the TV style, which we all loved in the end, I mean, the style was always brusque. Underneath it was this warm, beating heart that wanted you to do well. But he had high standards, therefore... he would look at you very quickly, and if you weren't pulling your weight even in your first game, there would be a stare. There'd be some sort of reaction that you'd realise you needed to up your game a bit.
Because you told me something about playing Headingley 81. I said that was an unbearable pressure. Mm. Like, so watching the Super Over, say for instance, I thought the pressure of this is unbelievable. And then I kind of thought, what would it be like to be on pitch? I asked you once about being on the pitch at the end of Headingley 81, and you said something to me that makes me understand what it's like being a sports person, because I said, oh, what are you thinking? And you said, it must be so terrifying. And you said, well, the great thing about being on the pitch is the ball could come towards you and I know I would catch it and then we'd win. Whereas in my head I was thinking, the last thing I would want to happen if I was on the field of play would be the ball to come anywhere near me, whereas you have that kind of, that desire. So, well, of course, you didn't go out for the Super Over, but still, you must have had a terrific seat, Mark. You must
No better than yours. But I think the thing I would say about Bob Willis there was, like, we, from a player's point of view, we used to think that, God, he's been a bit harsh on me at times there. And then I went for food with him, Broad, and Anderson. We did like a fast bowlers thing to speak to Bob about bowling and give us some advice. And he was literally our biggest fan. I was like, this is the same guy that says, like, well, lengths are rubbish, well, lines are rubbish, all this kind of, and it was the part he was playing for the TV.
He's bowled like a drain, he's fielded like a donkey.
Exactly, but underneath it, he was our biggest supporter, wanted us to do well, and actually give us some nice tips and advice when I didn't think that he was like that.
I suppose the neutrality is part of the job, isn't it?
Well, I was going to ask David, as being part of Sky, it must be hard being an ex-player to then comment on players, and you know what it's like, but you're having to give an opinion. It must be quite difficult.
Not for long. I think there is that. I mean, going back to Bob very briefly, it's because he cared. That's the first thing. And he cared that England did well, do well, and always will do well. And he set very high standards. When you make the transition, the initial problem is that you're now talking about people who you might have been in a dressing room a year ago, 6 months ago, alongside them. But you learn very quickly that that if you kind of lie, I mean, you can soften the blow. You instinctively sort of kind of soften your criticism because they are mates and because they're people you know well. But you very quickly learn that actually the greater audience out there, a lot of them know all about it as well. And if you're pulling your punches, it's very obvious to them. And it's also equally obvious to your producers and to your people, the people next door to you. So actually, very quickly, you learn that the only word you need to be aware of is honesty. If you found yourself ever being sort of guided by other principles, then you're going to struggle.
I think, because ultimately, the criticism that hurts the most is the criticism that you agree with, isn't it? And you think, oh, no, it's been voiced. I didn't do that. Well,
we have to turn the TV off now in the dressing room. That's like the coach... I mean, that's been always been the way since I've been the team. You watch the footage because you want to see what's happening. Is the ball swinging? Is it moving? But actually in the dressing room as players, we turn the commentary off because, if Rory Burns nicks off, and he comes into the dressing room and he puts his stuff down, and the first thing he hears is, oh, look at Burns' technique here. He's drifted off. He knows in his own head what he's done wrong or what he needs to work on. I mean, social media is massively part of it now, I think, for the modern players. And to me,
that seems terrifying. The idea of being out on a stage like that and then saying, people being able to contact you. Well, imagine if you were on Twitter when at the time you were being captain, the times that you were captain. Mm-hmm. I mean, already, what's the pressure of being an England captain like? Without extra voices in your ear.
If it's going well, it's absolutely lovely. If you're having problems, it's still a nightmare. I mean, if I've been able to carry a mobile phone at Trent Bridge in 1989, I could have saved having to invite the 12th man onto the field, who was Greg Thomas. I was kind of buying time and sort of trying to deflect and trying. It was a desperate tactic. I got him on and said, do me a favour, will you go to the press box and ask them what the fuck I do next? and he went, are you serious? I said, no. It'd be very nice. Thank you very much. But at least you could have turned the phone on. Not you can. I mean, this is whimsical. And said, well, yes, there's a fella in Yorkshire who suggests that we... What? Well, we might as well try it. Everything else is failed, you know. Social media adds an unwanted dimension to the pressure of being judged all the time. If you're playing a test match, you're being judged instantly by TV. Yes, you're being judged instantly by the people watching that TV. You're judged by your colleagues in the dressing room, at least, you know, sympathetic and wanting to do well. And in the old days, you had newspapers. So, and the same thing used to happen in a different way where people say, well, don't bother. Yeah, don't read the newspapers. If you had a bad day, you don't need to read about it again the following morning before you start your next day. Just ignore it. But I guess the same thing applies, which is if someone's written something about you, albeit in an old-fashioned newspaper, and someone else reads it and says, have you seen what so-and-so has written about you? You know, the damage is done again. And so whichever way you get your criticism fed through to you, you have to still have that strength of mind and purpose and clarity and focus that allows you to start again and believe you're going to have a good day. So, and let's face it, the worst thing actually is before anyone else even decides to put their opinions out there, you as an individual, if you're honest with yourself, will know what you've done right or wrong. So actually you're probably already beating yourself up before some poor old bloke has gone for the phone and something, at Mark Wood, wherever it might be. You're rubbish. So you're already beating yourself up. Therefore, you're already going through the process of how do I repair the damage.
I think that's the best thing is try and stay off it. It would be like most players now, but you can't. If you're looking at everything, when are you switching off then? Because you're in the game, you're disappointed that something's happened. You then go to your hotel or you go home, and if you're thinking about it all night and you're letting these comments bother you, you're then not switching off because then you're thinking about the comments all night, you're thinking about how you're going to play the next day. So it's a constant then mental battle of when are you actually mentally switching off, whereas you can be disappointed, and then if it's the end of the day, right, I'm disappointed, you go for some food or a drink or whatever, and then the next day, right, I'm ready to start again. And
are you, when you're out on the field of play, though, are you ever switching off? I'm not going to ask you the same question, David.
In between balls, I would say you do, yeah.
You're really genuinely, though. Yeah. Because that's an important part of your sort of armour, with switching off between just off,
I mean, I've
on,
seen
on,
players
on,
who are never switching off, and they are drained mentally much quicker, much more quickly. If you have that ability to sort of focus, play, whether you play and miss, hit it for four, whatever you might do, unwind, because if you've got Michael Holding going 40 yards back, you've got a lot of thinking to do. So if you're tense for that, watching him go back to the end of his run, that's a lot of tension. Yeah. Whereas if you can sort of switch off and look around and...
As someone then, a cricket fan that's been following, I mean, both of you as players, I'm kind of fascinated by the difference between the eras in which you play. There are aspects of the game that you played, David, that are unrecognisable to the modern game. And I dare say that the reverse is true. I mean, how do you think you would cope, Mark, playing in David's era?
I think I would have struggled injury-wise even more, to be honest. I think
because of the relentlessness.
Relentlessness, the fact that, you know, the physios, now we've got three or four, you can go in between, they come across all across the country, my workload's managed. Whereas then I think, I mean, I could have this wrong, but I think it was sort of like, you were seen as soft if you didn't keep bowling. If you weren't on the field all the time, and even when you were sore and injured, if you weren't still out there bowling 90 mile an hour, I would guess you were like seen as soft. The fact that, you know, 1% as the fact that the lifestyle after the game wouldn't have fitted the way that the teetotal sort of having to look after my body, icing 3 or 4 times a night, trying to get my ankle swelling down for the next day. I'm not sure that would have really fitted into the team culture or the team environment then. So
you get through quite a lot of ice at night, don't you?
Well, David? Say, that was an obvious link, yes, in a glass. Yeah, I mean, things were primitive in comparison 40 years ago. So the quality of healthcare, the quality of management in terms of player management, time and effort and fitness and all the rest of it, very, very different. I would have enjoyed central contracts, I think. And I remember, I mean, that infamous, that famous 81 test at Headingley. Everyone at the end of that day, you know, there's champagne to be drunk, but not too much, because everyone was getting into a car at the end of that game and going to the other end of the country to play an NatWest game somewhere potentially. Well, you know, you had to go and play a game the following day.
I just couldn't believe that. I can't believe that they would have done that like then.
Well, even then,
how as a bowler could you remain fresh? Or constantly bowling at 70% then, and especially the intensity.
Where people
of
say, why does Angus Fraser always look so tired? And you're like, because presumably he's bowling 25 overs a day from mid-April till September.
And he does have a naturally tired face, but yeah. So, but no, it's right. It was a very different thing where, and again, sort of just the era before me, as people like, as you say, Illingworth was my captain at Leicester, Brian Close for Beefy at Somerset, and things like pain were, you know, not acknowledged. So, you know, if you had, as a bowler, you have pain pretty much all the way through your career.
So as players then, would you both rather have played in this era, do you think? You seem to be playing in absolutely the right era for you.
I think personally I would. I think I would have enjoyed maybe some of the pitches, because there were, nowadays they suck the moisture out of them a lot because of the drainage and things, so they haven't got as, they don't do as much, but I think from, you know, purely being looked after and being able to constantly bowl at high pace and manage my injuries, I think this year I would be a lot better. And I kind of believe that, you know, they would play the next day, you know, mental fatigue, injury, physical, all the things that you think of. I think that's just a bit crazy.
If you went from a test match where you're inevitably drained at the end of a test match, good or bad, if you've won, you put a lot of energy in, but you've got the excitement of winning. If you've lost, you've still put energy in, and you've got the deflation of losing. And if you've then driven for 3 hours that night, and your alarm goes at 7:30 in the morning to get up and play Lincolnshire, and you know, you're not exactly enthused. So, again, you have to sort of wait until that moment where you walk out and think, well, can I make this a good day? And that's not the preparation that these guys have nowadays, when they're pitching up for any game, actually, be it county or international.
I think the similarity, I would say, between eras is that you get your sort of superstars, Botham and Stokes, I would say.
Well, yeah, you know, they would play alongside these extraordinary sort of talismanic figures that kind of transcend, you know. And you had some of this as well, David. It's not, you're not just, they're not just famous to cricketers. You know what I mean? It's bigger than that to cricket fans. I mean, you've obviously watched, you played a lot with both of them, you've watched a lot of Stokes. How do you think they compare? I know he's currently a teammate of yours, but
I think it's brilliant. I mean, I think in the end there's a severe danger that my long-standing friend and colleague might be just overtaken because of, actually, I'll tell you one big difference at the moment. Ian, when he was young, was instinctive, was fit, was strong, was brilliant. And his record probably, I mean, if you say for the first 8 years or so, was outstanding. And then as life sort of changed a bit, and you know, his last few years, he made the most of his reputation. And I remember that 86-7 tour of Australia where he bowled at the MCG, probably two-thirds fit, at two-thirds pace, still picked up 5 wickets because the Aussies thought, well, it's still Beefy. And he bowled loopy bouncers, which got nicked to the keeper, and long hops, which got hit to deep square leg, picked up 5.
But he had that fire, didn't he? The 92 World Cup, you know.
Oh, yeah, no, but he's still going for, I mean, that 92 World Cup in Australia, where he sort of got his mojo back, opened the innings, became the pinch hitter, picked up wickets. I mean, he loved that. Absolutely. And they should have won that. I mean, that should have been England's first World Cup against Pakistan at the MCG. But it just didn't turn out that way. The thing about Ben, I suspect, is that his sort of strength and fitness, because he's the hardest working cricketer I've heard of. And so, although he's had injuries, yeah, but his attitude to keeping himself fit and his attitude on the field, I think, will sort of sustain him longer, possibly.
I just can't believe for his work ethic, for such a good player, you'd think at some point he could take his back seat, or he's done enough catching the day. The next day, he's taking blinded one-handed catches, but not just one or two, just 30 or 40 to make sure that if he gets that one chance in the game, he takes it. Yeah. Same with it, and then he'll run, do sprints around the ground and things like that. It's just a phenomenal person, but I cannot be too biased one way or another, because one of them's my chairman and the other one's close friend, so I've got to be careful which one I choose.
let me enjoy the freedom of speech of having known your chairman for a long, long time. The other thing I need to say about Ian, in a sense, it's slightly flippant, is that his career lasted about 30 years because it didn't stop at 6 o'clock of the evening.
Yes.
Yeah, full on, all day, every day.
Proper air miles.
So, the genuine all-rounder.
I think that's the thing with both of them as well. It's like the influence matches, key moments, things where you think you're beaten, he never ever gives up. And that's the same with Beefy. I think, you know, it wasn't just the fact that they were great cricketers and...
The ability to make other people believe.
But it was
that's the work of a cult leader, isn't it?
You know, everything else that comes with it, exactly, yeah.
Who would have been someone that you would have looked at in your dressing room, any dressing room you played in, thought, I would love to be more like that person?
Ooh, good question. I'll duck it by saying I didn't really think that way. I would look round. I mean, both of them as the, as you say, cult figure in our dressing room, was the one who would stand up at any moment of crisis and say, right, I'll leave it to me, I'll sort him out.
I'll bounce him out.
It didn't always work, but... I mean, some of those team meetings were fueled by things other than reason. and so you had to kind of take that and understand it, but it's that spirit. I mean, and whereas, Ben, we have the distinct impression, the wild days are over as far as Ben is concerned. And you just look up to someone like that to make something happen. The difference is also that I suspect Ian, who opened the bowling for a lot of his first part of his career, Ben is now settling into a role as your third-stroke four-seamer and being looked after. So he's going to make more runs, and he ain't going to challenge in the same way for the sheer number of wickets, probably because of the balance of the team. So unless the balance of that team changes, at the moment it doesn't look like the three-seamers and two-spinners thing is going to get many outings. Whereas for us in the mid-80s, I mean, I found as captain that suited the era and suited the people we had available, some of our really good times in the 80s. So we had Edmonds and Embry available, and we'd have both of them as the all-rounder and two other proper quick bowlers.
And you were sort of happy to captain difficult characters, I suppose, like Edmonds,
I enjoyed that. Philippe, I loved captaining Philippe because the interesting thing to me was that he and Brearley didn't get on, because Philippe was a very challenging character. I mean, they're both intellectual giants. And Philippe loved an argument. But if you got drawn into the argument, sort of sucked into it, it's like a piece of cheese in front of the mouse. Here's the trap. That was the worst thing. If you accepted that your intellect was slightly less than his and just talked normally to him, he was fine. And I took Philippe to India 84-5, and I had a fantastic time. Enjoyed him immensely. We had four good months out there, won the series, and he was very much part of that. Whereas Brearley found him, just didn't really find the key. So, Brears would quite often just leave him out. Philip would get angry, and they'd sort of ignore each other for 5 days and then try again. I quite enjoyed that. I mean, I think having said that, the art of captaincy, which Brearley was brilliant at. I mean, Brears, as good as I've seen, admittedly right at the start of my career, so you believe that they're God because everything they say seems like wisdom. As your career develops, I think you start to challenge people more readily. But I just enjoyed the part where you have all these different people, and yes, you find some easier to deal with than others, and some speak your language. And if you haven't, I mean, I don't mean literally, but I suppose nowadays it's almost relevant. But if you to get inside someone's head, you need to be able to sort of work out what the key is. What is it, stick or carrot? Is it long words, short words, whatever it might be. You've got to find a way to find a level.
Mark, final question from you to David.
Well, I originally wanted to ask, would he ask long or short words to me? Because obviously the long words would be particularly challenging. No, I just want to ask you, out of all of the places that you've played and been, what was your favourite ground? Which one would you love to play at one more time?
I think the SCG. I had a lot of fun in Australia in all sorts of ways, a lot of runs in Australia. I love the way they play the cricket down there. And Sydney still has a little bit more of the history evident at the ground. I mean, they've all changed dramatically in the last 40 years. Playing at Melbourne's extraordinary just for the sheer numbers that come in on Boxing Day. But the Sydney Cricket Ground has something with that old pavilion. So, I mean, there's something... I mean, for instance, Melbourne, if you go in the dressing rooms now, well, they're basically new. At Sydney, you could still go into that dressing room and imagine Bradman and Hutton and Hobbs and Compton and... You know, all the, you know, sort of the great legends of the game from 30, 40 years ago. In my case...
It's like wooden, isn't it? Wooden benches.
A lot of old wooden. I mean, they've refurbished a bit,
yeah.
I'm hoping they've done it again by now. But there was still... You know, you could still look at the locker thinking, I wonder who used that? You know, there was that sort of feeling about... And you walk out, you know, with past the iron railings, down the side, onto the field, you know, through the picket fence, into the field of abuse. I just loved that atmosphere and that challenge. I mean, I used to find that very, very inspiring. One of my favourite hundreds was at Sydney on the Gooch Tour of 1991 for all sorts of reasons, actually. A, it was a pretty good 100, and B, we were having...
Atherton
was at the other end for most of that. I think he was on about
11 by the time you got out?
Probably. No, he was on about 60 when I got out there, and we vied for the 100, sort of 99, and thank you very much.
How would you know that about Atherton, Miles?
I'm quite a big fan of Michael Atherton. because David is Michael Atherton's hero, and Michael Atherton is my hero. So David is my sort of grand hero by that.
So he did. Yeah.
I don't feel old at all. I'm a big fan of Michael's too. Now we're talking about him. I think he's outstanding as a writer, outstanding as a judge of a game of cricket, and the way he talks about it, I think he's right up there.
Okay, now, David, do you know what time it is?
Do you know what time it is?
I know what time it is. It's time for Mark Wood's Super Over.
Well, hey.
By
the barest of margins.
Right, here we go. Right.
You've got to do that every week now.
Yeah, well, I reckon that was not bad.
I thought that was very good.
Oh, is that what it was? Fine, maybe.
Right, I'm going to ask you a series of questions. I just want you to bang out your answers as quick as you can. On your marks, are you ready, Miles?
The rules are no thinking, so, no thinking, David. Just
are you answering for me or
no? You're
keeping the.
I'm in charge of the time. I'm going to keep it on my Fitbit, which is it's had a quiet day so far. The rules of this are.
What is your resting heart rate at the moment?
It's 997, but I am with two legends. No thinking, only
no
speaking.
Thinking.
Is that fair?
Yep.
On your marks. That's all I've done is turn the notifications on. Hang on. On your marks, get set, go.
Mr. David Gower, favourite drink?
Lynch Bars.
Music band?
Genesis.
TV show?
QI.
Any superstitions?
Yes.
What were they?
left pad on first.
Great. Any addictions?
Lynch Bars.
Oh, nice. Favourite school lesson?
Free time.
Any good quotes or inspirationals?
Smile, it confuses people.
Nice. Would you rather whistle, clap, click or hum? Who's your worst roommate? Or who would be your worst roommate?
Both of them.
Nice. Any fashion disasters?
Very, very, very baggy jeans.
Okay, favourite childhood toy?
Teddy.
Hot bath or cold shower?
Hot bath.
That's 60 seconds. I think we should go over 90. I'm loving
it. Okay, that's we're nearly done. Name two types of trouser.
Well, there was the flare and the drain pipe.
And your favourite TV owl?
Wall. I don't know a TV owl.
By the barest of margins. Time off.
You do you know what? 85 seconds. You have completed Mark Wood's super over, and that is very impressive, David. And nothing's come along since Genesis to tickle your fancy, David.
Lots. Don't worry. I mean, it was a quick fire round.
I told you not to think.
You told me not to think.
Miles, I've got to ask David one more question before we let him go. Just because it's a modern question, I'd love to know. Obviously, I've been watching the IPL in the 2020. I've got to ask him about how he would have coped with modern day cricket, because all the great players would have adapted, but what he would have done with that cover drive and everything he had in that locker, that would have met him. Would he have had the scoop shot, do you think?
I'm not sure about a scoop. I mean, I suppose because the one thing I didn't like was wearing a visor in front of my face. Helmets, yes, they became easily usable and easy. You got used to the helmet, but I didn't really like much anything in front of me. So if you're going to play a scoop, you've got to have something in front of you. IPL and all that is a young man's game. And if I go back to the start of my one-day careers for Leicestershire and for England, then whatever the innovation was at the time, stepping away, hitting it over extra cover, all the shuffling around in the crease was prevalent then, and I was pretty good at that. One would adapt. And the encouraging thing I would have here, although I'm not a power player like Stokes or Gale or a lot of the guys playing now, the one guy who has a very good T20 record of the modern era, who is not a power man, is someone like Mahela Jayawardena, who could manoeuvre the ball with skill and timing and do some quite interesting things and get into places where there were no fielders.
Babar Azam is exactly the same.
Yeah, and have the strike rate that is effective for the game. So that would have been, if I was starting out, that would have been more my role model, someone like that.
But you used to hit the ball hard. I mean, it wasn't just grace and stuff. You did give it a whack.
Yeah, but I could only do that if I timed it. So if I got carried away and wanted to be, had dreams of
muscling it, yeah,
then everything went wrong. So yeah, head comes up and your rhythm goes and your timing goes, and so I was never any good at that. So but the things that they do nowadays, like range hitting. You learn to, basically learn new techniques, new ways of doing things. So
that's it then.
That's there.
A million lackers, RCB, David Gower next year. They're done. £1 million cricketer.
I mean, I'm prepared. Let's be.
I'll come out with the dog stick.
I'm prepared. Yeah, I'm prepared to take on that role of mentor for the same money. Yeah, maybe to this podcast, wherever it takes,
It is an absolute pleasure for me, for you as well, I hope, Mark.
Yes.
To have you with us here today. David Gower, thank you very much indeed.
My absolute pleasure.
Right, Miles, that was the notorious DIG, as you put it. Quite enjoyed that, did you?
That was great, yeah. I've met David a few times, actually, but it's just nice to see him. I really like that stuff where he, just when he starts getting really serious, I guess, you get a sense of, it's easy to think of him, isn't it, as just being sort of debonair and louche and stuff, but he's, just how much he cares as well about, not just about his own game, but about the game as a whole. It really matters to him.
David is someone that I've always looked up to, and I'm just what you're saying as well. I think the thing that I enjoyed most about listening to him talk was, actually, I know the show is about eras. There's sort of differences, but also that there was a lot of similarities as well, in the way that keeping things simple on the field, the same anxieties going out to bat or facing fast bowling. It's exactly the same nowadays. It doesn't change the pressures of international cricket, and it was nice to hear him talk about it and be so honest and open.
Do you feel, when you're talking to someone like him, you're both members of an elite club, and do you get that sense when you're talking to him? Do you think he respects you more because you are someone that, like him, has played for England, that has test caps?
Yeah, I think so. I think automatically you've got that sort of bond and respect there that you wouldn't have with someone that hadn't played for England. And it's not to anything to do with that personality or anything like that. It's just a bond
He just respects me less.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just, I actually sat at David's table. We had all past England players over every generation, and we got handed these caps with tassels on it, and it was very all your numbers on and your name, and it was a lovely gift. Everyone was there, and David was actually on my table, and as the current England player, I got to hand the cap out to some of the ex-players. It was so strange giving David his cap. I was like, you're a legend. I've hardly played. Here's your cap. Please respect me. And he took it really well. And he was a gentleman that night. And obviously, he was fantastic on the show there.
Well, that's the benchmark set for following guests. They've got to be candid. They've got to be vulnerable. They've got to open up to Dr. Mark.
Exactly. I'm an open book. Tell me your stories. And speaking of stories, if anybody at home, if you could send in anything that you've got, any stories you have from your local cricket club or backyard that have stood the test of time.
So what are the stories from your cricket club or your team that you play for that people still talk about?
One of the famous ones at Ashington is there was a guy opened the bowling for the second team years ago. It must have been the 70s. And he bowled basically a couple of wides. It wasn't very good. And the captain took him off. So in a bit of a huff, he went to fine leg and lay down at fine leg. And of course, the first ball the next over, where does the ball go? Straight to fine leg as he's lying on the floor. And because he's in such a huff and being a petulant child, this is a grown man, about 30 or 40, I think, at the time. As the ball comes trickling towards him, he's lying down with his elbow on the grass. He's fist against his head, relaxing. The ball is trickling straight towards him, and he lifts his arm up for the ball to go underneath his arm, and he puts his arm back down. It goes for four, and my second team captain says, "You might as well go home," or to words to those effects.
Thanks very much indeed for listening. If you have friends who you think might be interested in listening to this sort of thing, this podcast is available on all of the podcast apps, not just the one that you yourself have chosen to use. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and email us at middleplease@hotmail.com. Goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me. See you next time.
Oh, should be taken, and it's taken. Brilliant from Mark Wood. What a spell this has been.
Thanks to Mark and everyone behind the scenes, including cricketers Jin. Middle Please Umpire is an Electric production in association with Playback Media.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, it is your partner, Big Boy. Interested in giving back to your community while making new connections in your neighborhood? Introducing Neighbor to Neighbor, a California volunteers network that empowers you to take action, contribute to local needs, and be a part of something bigger than yourself. Visit caneighbors.com to learn more about how you can get to know your neighbor and strengthen your community. Neighbor to Neighbor, it takes a neighborhood. Hello.